examine the moral feeling right now. Dr. Larry Spagnuolo is a psychologist who himself has made several professional transitions during his career. He began as a clinical psychologist at the Community Mental Health Center with a specialization in early adolescent hydrocarbon inhalation. Interesting specialization. His next transition was an organization development consultant and entrepreneur. His focus is on executive career management and outplacement. Larry writes a blog about careers and has contributed to the Harvard Business Review and is extensively quoted on issues of career management by the Wall Street Journal. He often works with physician practice boards and senior professionals such as law firms and partners in law firms. Snabel, PP, Lincolnshire, now has 250 professionals in 25 U.S. locations and in 31 countries. He is currently the executive in residence at Suffolk University in Boston, and he is on the advisory board of the university in South Korea. So we're very fortunate to have him with us today. And by the way, Dr. Stivell is a licensed psychologist in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You've been sitting down for a long time. You want to stretch? Yeah. Just. All right, that's enough. Sit down. You notice I have this kind of funny-looking thing on my chest. This is a microphone. I'm making an MP3 file from this talk. I'm going to host it on our website. I'm also going to give Jane a copy of the MP3 for the Mass Psych Association, so if you want to download it. If any of you would like a copy of this file, just give me your business cards or scribble a name on a piece of paper, give me your email, and I'll be glad to send you the MP3 file when this is through. I want to thank Jane Appel for bringing me here, and Mark Fanger as well for suggesting it. I obviously was listening to Carol and Elena with a lot of concerns. But I also, you know, to put it into some sort of larger context, it's not going to help you, but it's going to put it in a larger context. What you're going through is going through just about every industry that I consult with. There's really nothing that's unique here. Indeed, I'm reminded that here in the United States, we talk about the Great Recession. And then we're obsessed with when will the Great Recession be over. Now, the implication is the Great Recession is an anomaly. And when the Great Recession's over, we go back to the way things were. I think the Spanish are a little bit more sophisticated about these things. They do not refer to the Great Recession that we're in. They refer to the times before the Great Recession as when we thought we were rich. But think about the implications of that. When we thought we were rich implies that we were living in a sort of false environment. And the false environment was low interest rates combined with a lot of stimulation in the economy made people feel richer than they actually were. And now things have come home to roost. So it's not necessarily the case that when the economy gets better, we go back to where things were. So I'm reminded of this because I see the same exact parallel that you're dealing with that the cable industry is dealing with. Cable industry is founded on a very basic, simple business model. People love television. Once they get hooked up on cable, it'll be like the utility rates. And it'll be just part of their budget, and they'll never give it up. And so we've got a business model that it's just a money machine. Problem is, it's not working out that way. as one of the downturns in the recession, people are dropping their basic cable service. The second is the rise of the internet, which was totally unforeseen. It's an alternative to cable. And then young kids aren't even on television anymore. They get their entertainment off their computers. So we are seeing subscriptions drop and drop in the cable industry. Two quarters in a row, the industry's experience drops. What are they doing? They're repricing their entire package. Basic cable in New York City is $75 a month. They're now coming up with a new program which is $30 a month. But what do you get for $30 a month? You've got to drop a lot of options. What's the difference between what the cable industry is doing and what healthcare is doing? So the two questions is, how do you do what you do? And then how do what you do in a completely different way? And that's what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about what I call pivots, professional pivots. I love to watch ballet dancers. I love to watch football players. I love to watch hockey players because they do this thing. I can't do it. They do it. And that's I call it pivot. And I don't know if you could tell me a better name for it. That I'd love it. A pivot is when you change direction while in motion. Not coming to a stop and then deciding to go to another direction, but changing direction while in motion. It's a beautiful thing to watch. But I also am aware that it is fraught with danger. You could get injured. I'm also aware you cannot win games or do a successful dance unless you pivot. And I'm going to talk about three pivots in my professional life. I'm going to tell you three simple stories. No big deals. They're all stories about my life. And then after each one, I'll tell you what were the lessons learned. And after the third one, I'll have an exercise for you. Now, we may do two of the stories this morning and then the third this afternoon. I'm going to be here all day. I'm going to be observing some of the programs. I'd like to talk with you. And then in the afternoon, I'll be here to help with the wrap-up. The first story of a pivot in my life is called The Burden of Being Conscientious. Both my parents are German. English is my second language. German was my first language. And as a German, I get an almost erotic satisfaction out of making checklists and then crossing them off. Under certain circumstances, you could say I'm obsessive compulsive, but usually I'm just conscientious. And people like me like to set long-term distant goals that are relatively achievable. In other words, it's not pie in the sky, nor is it that easy, but relatively achievable. And I like to set really concrete goals. So I was 26 years old, and I had a real concrete goal in my life. I wanted to go to Texas Tech University and get a PhD in clinical psychology. Now, why Texas Tech? Because they have the best program in the country for Adlerian psychology. I decided that's the thing for me. Then after that, I was going to move to Austin, Texas. I was going to open up a private practice. I was going to have a nice life. My fallback would be Dallas, Texas. Now, this was actually a very achievable and concrete goal. I had a master's degree in psychology from the University of Texas at Austin. I was a staff psychologist at a community mental health center in Dallas, Texas. I had a little specialty in dealing with alcohol and drug abuse, and I already published a piece in the International Journal of the Addictions. So all my goals were on track, and I was moving along with them. I'm very conscientiously doing this. My wife, Mary Ann, then decides she wants to get an MBA. The best business school in Dallas, Texas is Southern Methodist University. She gets accepted into SMU. This derails my plans for 2 years, but that's okay. I'm going to be the supportive husband, and et cetera. September rolls around, and there is a party for the incoming students and their significant others. I don't like to go to parties. And I certainly don't like to go to parties under conditions that my job is not to cause notice to myself. So I wasn't looking forward to this party, but I went. And I'm just going around, you know, making small talk with people, and I meet a guy named Mick. And I say to Mick, "Mick, what do you do?" And he says to me, "I do OD." Now again, coming from my background in alcohol and drug abuse, I had the same reaction you did. I kind of laugh. And I say, well, Mick, I'm a psychologist, but in my world, you don't do OD. You are on OD. It happens to you. So I think the way you use OD is different than the way I use it. What is OD to you? He says, well, OD is the application of clinical psychology, social psychology, sociology, and anthropology to two things. Helping people be more effective in their work and helping be more committed to their organizations. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, okay. Nothing but, oh, okay. That night, Marianne asked me, what did you think of the party? And the thing that stood out most was the OD kind of thing, and my laughing like you did. And that was it. Then in November, I found myself in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. How many of you have ever been to Fort Sill, Oklahoma? Anybody? You have. Okay. Is it barren or not?
It's barren.
It is barren. If any of you have seen pictures of Afghanistan, Fort Sill is pretty close, right? It's probably, you know, I don't know what they're doing with it today, but I would think that if I was doing a training ground for Afghanistan, Fort Sill would be a pretty good place for that. There's nothing to do on the base, and even less to do when you get off the base, right? So I'm there for 2 weeks as part of my Army Reserve training. And the guy who's in the barracks with me says, hey, why don't we get plastered? And in the context of what there was to do at Fort Sill, that seemed like a very reasonable thing. So here's what we did. We went to the local store on the base, which is called the PX. And we got the following things, and if you want to write this down, you can. We got a hefty trash bag, you know, the kind that for leaves and contract, you know, heavy, really heavy. Then we got ice, lots of ice, about 3 pounds of ice. Then we got vodka, lots of vodka. And then we got this powder. It's lemonade, you know, you put it in and it turns into lemonade. It's amazing what technology's come up with. And so we here, write this down. You find a trash can. You put the hefty trash bag in the can because we want to be, you know, sanitary about this. You put the ice in there. You put the vodka in there. And then you sprinkle it off with the lemonade. Take an M16, the butt of an M16 rifle, and just go like that. Voila! Now, I had one drink. It just tasted sweet. I had two drinks, and I was intoxicated. And then I'd had three drinks, which was a really bad move. I mean, I've been this drunk 3 times in my life, and you don't want to know about the other 2 times. And I understood what the term blind drunk meant, because I couldn't see. And I also knew I was going to pass out. And so I'm trying to move as gracefully as I can to my bed so that I can flop. I'm really concerned that I'm just going to pass out before I reach the bed. And I'm standing there wobbling in the bed, and I realize I do not have the coordination to take my shoes off. And I'm just going to flop on the bed. And just before I do, I say, I need to write a note to myself because I will forget about this in the morning. So I take out a pen and I write a note to myself. I place it under my pillow. I go to bed and I totally go to sleep. And in the morning I wake up, I've got my fatigues on, my boots are on, I've got a terrific hangover. I forget about the note. I go about the day. That evening, I'm going back to bed, and I'm fluffing the pillow, and there's this note. And I read the note, and it's my handwriting. And it says, do OD. And I did. And I said, I thought to myself, very poetically, I had to get myself blind drunk in order to see. What I really had to do was I had to chemically disable my higher cognitive functions in order so that my real feelings could show itself, which was, I didn't want to do clinical psychology. I wanted to do OD, but I wasn't willing to acknowledge that that's what I wanted to do, and I had to get blind drunk in order to see. So that there is a cocktail party at the end of this. We MPAs kindly supplying the hefty trash bags. But here's the point of the story. My fatal weakness is I'm conscientious. It's been a great strength in my life. It's gotten me where I am. But when you're in a period of extreme turbulence like we are all dealing with, conscientiousness can make you blind, like it was making me blind. Let me put this in a research perspective. This is a research that came out this month in the Academy of Management Journal. Here's the title. If anybody would like a copy of the research, give me your cards and I'll be glad to send it to you. The title of it all, it says it all. CEO Personality, Strategic Flexibility, and Firm Performance. The case of the Indian business processing outsource industry. They were looking at one industry in one country in one city, business process outsourcing in India. And they were looking at CEO personality and its effect on strategic adaptability to changing times and sales and revenue. And what they found was that CEOs who are highly conscientious do a terrible job under unstable conditions. Because they're so conscientious, they're wedded to a certain course of action. Those CEOs that seem to do the best for their firms or are more strategically adaptable are those who are openness to change and new experiences. And there is a yin and yang between conscientiousness and openness to new experience. How do you find the right balance? The point that I'm making is the difficulties that you're going through right now as psychologists in healthcare are being replicated thousands of times in Boston by your clients and potential clients in other industries. And they're also going through strategic and business and personal incoherence. And the very conscientiousness that got them to this level of success are now going to maybe be in their undoing. You could be an alternative to a garbage bag full of vodka. You have tools. You could be of help to them. You'll notice I have not, during any of this talk, used any diagnostic term, any psychiatric term, because it is not psychotherapy. It is using the power of your clinical skills to help people who need help. So that's story number one. Story number two. Honoring your clinical skills. Fast forward. I've now got my doctorate in organization behavior. I got it my idea of Valhalla was Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas. I actually got into the Harvard Graduate School of Education and got an EDD in organization behavior. So I really did a turnaround. The first real job I get is with a global management consulting firm called Hay Associates, and it does executive compensation. And I was the only organization development person in that sort of entering class. And what Hay did was that they brought all of the new people to Philadelphia to show them, you know, the leaders, and the leaders would come and talk. But really, it was like a three-day program on how to sell professional services. And there were like maybe 30 of us in the class. I was the only OD, I was the only psychologist in the room. Everybody else had an MBA from a very prestigious school, Harvard, Stanford, Wharton, that sort of thing. All of them had at least 3 years of very solid business experience. And I was the only person, my only experience was clinical experience, and I had a doctorate in organization behavior. And what that meant was I never took an accounting class, I never took a marketing class, never took a sales class. It was only a psychology degree, and I really felt outclassed. And then, as the pinnacle of the course is that we're given a Harvard Business School case. We're supposed to break up in teams, and then we're supposed to sell a CEO on our solution. And they brought in a real CEO to listen to the four presentations, and then the real CEO would then decide who's going to get the assignment. And that was going to be the pinnacle of the case. So we're brought up into four teams. And in my team, there's a guy from Harvard Business School, and he's a German. And he starts putting up a model that he thinks makes a lot of sense. And I kind of understand the model from this level, but it's just way too complicated. It's just not my sweet spot. Everybody else in the team is nodding their heads and says, "Well, that makes a lot of sense." And he comes up with this idea of a 4-year program of $5 million to help this company out of its problems. And everybody nods their heads and they say, "Well, that makes a lot of sense." And then he proceeds to make the PowerPoint slides for this thing, and it's very sophisticated and lovely. He then overplays his hand and he alienates a lot of people. And so when they decide to pick who's going to make the presentation, the CEO, they decide to pick me. And I think they picked me because I was the only person without an MBA. And I was the least threatening, because everybody else had an MBA from another school. They picked me, and I said, "Sure, okay, I can make the presentation." As luck would have it, our group randomly, my group is the last group to make a presentation. I'm listening to the other three groups that are making the presentation to the CEO. They're all making the same presentation. Well, that makes a lot of sense, because they all went to the same kind of schools. They all studied the same kind of Harvard cases. They all came up with the same kind of model. And they all came up with something which was like a 4 or 5 year program, anywhere between $3 to $5 million. And I realized, if I make the same presentation that they're making, I'm gonna fail. So what do? So it's my turn to make a presentation. And again, we have this German guy had spent all the time with the PowerPoints. And I said, "Forget about the PowerPoints. I'm not going to do this." So CEO's sitting over here. And I pull up a chair. Uncross your legs. So he's got his legs right here. And I sit right next to him. And I go just like this. So my knees are almost touching his knees. And I lean forward to him, and I start talking very, very softly. Then he's leaning forward so he can hear me. And so we form a kind of a triangle. And nobody can hear us except him and me. And I just go back to the basic 101 clinical intervention skills that I had learned in Dallas, Texas. And it was something like the following. I'd like to summarize what I think is going on, and I'd like you to tell me if I'm right. Am I correct that your company is in serious trouble, and if you do nothing, you certainly will get fired, and the stock will go down, and the employees will suffer, and the shareholders will suffer? He says, "Yes, you're right, Larry." "Tom, am I also correct that if you accept the other team's ideas of a 4 or 5 year project with a $3 to $5 million commitment, you run the risk of bringing in a company that may not really understand your culture, may not click with your employees, and then if you do the wrong intervention, you're down $5 million, and at the very least, you'll be embarrassed, but more likely, you'll get fired. Is that correct?" He says, "Yeah, that's right, Larry." I said, "Well, it sounds like you're in a dilemma. You know, here's something, this is classic. Here's an option to consider. Instead of a 4 or 5 year program, why don't we just do an executive compensation study? That'll be about $30,000. We can knock that off in 3 months. By the end of 3 months, you can then decide are we the kind of people that will work well with you and your company? Then we can go on to the next project. If, on the other hand, you decided, you know, we're not the right kind of people for you and our approach is not the right, well, it's the end of the project, you're out $30,000, and then you select somebody else. So it reduces your risks. He then starts laughing, and he says, I'm buying Larry Stibel's stuff. He's the only one that really understood my position from my point of view. He's the only one to try to understand me. I'm going with Larry Stibel. And the lesson that I learned from that was that we tend to undermine our own confidence in the skills that we have learned. Businesses spending millions of dollars every year to teach people the skills that you know, which is how to listen, how to put your own ego on the shelf and really try to put yourself in a client's shoes without being but still maintain a distance, how to talk to a client in a way that allows the client to feel empowered. These are kind of second nature skills that you have. But believe me, once you get out of psychology, they're very rare skills. And you've got skills there that can be used. My third story is how I found out what I wanted to do in 10 years. I'm going back to Harvard. I was on the cusp of graduating. And I had several directions that I could do. I could actually go back into clinical psychology if I wanted. I could go into industry, and I had a job opportunity with a high technology company. I could go into consulting, or I could go into teaching. I said, normally I'm a conscientious guy, and I tend not to be obsessive compulsive, but there are times I will be obsessive compulsive. When I'm put in one of these choice decisions, I get paralyzed. You know, I just get obsessive compulsive. And this was one of those things. I could do this, this, or this. What are you going to do? And I did the classic OCD kind of things. I would make lists. And of course, all the lists, when I add up the numbers, they all add up. They're all the same. You know, I was driving my wife crazy. She was an executive at a company, and they had one of these work-life balance retreats at a hotel. And so I came in, again, as the accompanying spouse for this program. And the guy who was running it is a former FBI agent. And basically, it was a pop psychology kind of program. I was sitting there, and I was just angry. I didn't like the guy. Plus, I thought, hey, I could do what he's doing, and I could do it better than he's doing it. I just didn't like this at all. But in the end, he sort of says, okay, now I want you to take a piece of paper, and I want you to talk about your life as it will be 10 years from now. And I want you to say, I wake up. And then don't just say, I wake up. You say, you wake up, and who's next to you? And when you get out of bed, what does the floor look like? Is it wood? Is it carpet? What kind of wood? What kind of carpet? When you look out the window of the bedroom, what do you see? Plan your whole day, 10 years from now, your whole day. So I did. I wrote it down real fast. Didn't think about it. Then he said, then I share it with your significant other, and we did, and we shared it. And then he said, okay, now what I want you to do is I'm handing out these envelopes. I want you to put it in an envelope. I want you to lick the envelope, and I want you to forget about it for 10 years. And he says, what you've now done is you have programmed your unconscious. And he says, the unconscious is like a missile. The missile doesn't really know when it's hitting its target. It just knows when it's off course. And that's how it hits the target, by always self-correcting when it knows it's off course. You've just created your unconscious to be a missile. Now I'm thinking to myself, this is crap. This is absolute psychobabble nonsense from a guy I don't respect. But of course, I'm his spouse, so I'm not going to make an argument. So I'm going to be nice. I'm going to smile. I'm going to do exactly what he said. I did exactly what he said. Put it in an envelope. Seal the envelope. Put it in a file cabinet. I forgot it for 10 years. As a matter of fact, I did so well, I forgot about it for 20 years. That's how good I was. I forgot about it. And so I'm cleaning out the file cabinet, and I find out this old file, and there's this old envelope, and I open the envelope, and I look at what I had written 20 years ago, and then I compare it to what happened in my life. And again, at the time I was writing it, I was at this choice point, and I was paralyzed because I couldn't figure it out. In my fantasy, I was living in a contemporary house on the water, surrounded by evergreen trees, which was totally different than where I was. I was living in Newton on California Street. In my fantasy, I was the Peter Drucker. Now, Peter Drucker was a very well-known, very esteemed management consultant. But I was his replacement. And in the morning, I was writing a column for the Wall Street Journal. And then in the afternoon, in my fantasy, a stretch limousine comes and the CEO of General Motors has come to my house to consult with me. And I have an office downstairs, and I'm going to see him downstairs. Now, noteworthy is I'm writing a column. I'm the Peter Drucker of my age, and Peter Drucker has both an academic appointment, and he's a consultant, and he's a writer. I'm living on the water. I'm in a contemporary house surrounded by evergreen trees, and the client has come to my house. What actually happened in my life? Well, in my life, as I didn't write a column for the Wall Street Journal. I write a column for Harvard Business Review. And for 10 years, I wrote a column on careers for Boston Business Journal. I live in a contemporary house in Wayland, Massachusetts, on the water, surrounded by trees. The nature of my work, which is career consulting and outplacement, is I do not go to clients. They come to me. I have an office in my house, but they don't come to my house. I have an office 6 miles away. Peter Drucker had an academic appointment. I have an academic appointment. And I looked at that exercise, and I said, wow, I wasn't thinking of this at all. This was the total fantasy that I did to comply with requirements from a guy I didn't like, an exercise I didn't believe in, and it was pretty good. Maybe the unconscious is like a guided missile. Maybe it doesn't know what it wants to do, it just knows when it's off course. Maybe that's the same with my story about why I had to get blindingly drunk in order to see. I was off course. My unconscious knew it was off course, and the only way it could tell me it was off course was for me to get drunk. So, here's my challenge for you. I want you to take out a piece of paper. This is only for you. Nobody else is going to see it. I'm going to do the same instructions that I was given 25 years ago. Now, for those of you who expect, I could see there are some people in the room who will still have careers in psychology in 10 years, and some of you may not have careers in psychology. But the issue is, where do you want to be in 10 years? So, where do you want to, let's just start, we can continue this in the afternoon as well. So, here's the exercise. It's 10 years from now, it's Friday, 10 years from now. You begin by saying, I wake up. And then, when you wake up, who's in bed with you? And when you wake up, what does your bedroom look like? And when you wake up and get out of the bed, what does the floor look like? And when you look out the window, what does the window, what's outside the window? And then, and just follow that day. Just follow the data, and just don't screen anything out. Just whatever makes sense.